Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This is a Small Bites episode where we chat about the small and big things that make a great hospitality venue. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Small Bites episode of the Food Fight podcast with me, your host, Stefan Postumagrbic, alongside...
Full name yourself.
That's it. That's my full name. Alongside Simon Evans.
Simon Martin Evans.
Is that your middle name? Martin?
Yeah.
Like Brian Martin or Martin Freeman? Two favourites.
It's M-A-R-T-A-N, yeah. Yeah, I was named after Brian Martin.
Chris Martin, the good
New Zealand bowler. Oh,
anyway. Oh, Coldplay. Yeah. There's another Chris Martin.
I assume that was the one you meant.
No. I'm talking about Kiwi bowlers. He's the worst batsman in cricket cricket history.
Fast bowler.
Yeah, pace bowler. Yeah. Right. All right. This is all well and good. I mean, the name Martin and my name. But we're really not getting anywhere yet, Simon. So why don't we get stuck into this Small Bites episode?
Mm.
We decided we'll talk about what makes a good restaurant, cafe, or bar. Because you said the word intangible before when we were talking about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good one. So, I mean, let's start with restaurants. And once we get going, you know us. We'll just talk about it.
Mm.
What makes a good restaurant, Simon?
Well, I think you should sort of just start with the obvious stuff and then get a bit more specific. Like your the quality of your product and your staff make a good venue.
Yes.
Across the board.
Yes.
That's kind of a given. So I think it's more those little things that take something from just being like, it's good food, to being like, it's a great restaurant. Or a great, you know, it's good coffee to a great cafe.
Mm.
And like, yeah, there's kind of just lots of little things. Like, for me, the kind of the general vibe of a place, again, quite an intangible thing. How do you measure vibe? And also that initial interaction you have with staff is really key.
Mm.
Whether it's just like, because some places, like, you can walk in and they don't even really acknowledge you.
Yeah.
And I think that's just, it's such a small little thing. Especially if you're going into like a bar you haven't been into before, a cafe you haven't been into before, and you're kind of trying to suss it out. If someone did you just says like, hi.
I'll be with you in a second.
And or smiles whatever, at like, you.
Yeah.
Like that just goes a long way.
Yeah.
And it's little things like that.
I used to get so frustrated at this place that I was front of house manager for a little while. And yeah, like you try to teach people who, I mean, and you can't really blame young people who are quite inexperienced in hospitality, but like just there were two different entrances to the venue, which always makes it difficult to figure out how you greet people and things like that, especially when you're busy. But just teaching people to just, if there's someone that's standing around that looks like they're lost,
yeah,
you have to go talk to them,
yeah,
and say hi, like, can I help you? I'll be with you in a minute. You know, if you just cleared a table or whatever it might be, but making people feel as if they're recognized as soon as they enter, surely is like one of the most important things off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first impressions go a long way.
Yeah.
And there's like nothing more shitty than like that awkward thing where you kind of step into a restaurant. Again, you don't quite know if, oh, like, am I waiting to be seated? Do I go up to the thing? Like, do I go up to a counter and talk to someone? Like, and that little kind of second before someone does say something, it can be just really awkward and weird.
Yeah.
When you're sort of standing around, and you're like, oh, what do we do here?
Isn't it funny, though, that, like, I mean, you might go to a restaurant and spend, whatever. Like, you might go to a restaurant and spend $100 each on food. And the expectation of service, I mean, and it is called hospitality, and you do pay for service in a sense, but it's just weird how that doesn't translate in any other industries. So, like, you can be paying your bank in the mortgage that you're paying off, or you can be paying your, you know, you could even be going to Bunnings or something like that and spending way more than $100 bucks on a meal, but the service that you get is just absolute shit. Like,
yeah,
with a bank, like, all you want sometimes is just to find someone on the phone to ask a question to, and it'll take you like 45 minutes of being on hold. And then if you want to go to Bunnings and buy something and find the right thing, like, there might be someone who greets you at the door, but then you just cannot find one person in the whole thing to give you a hand.
I mean, although Bunnings staff are pretty legit. Like, you're like, oh, where's this weird thing I need? And they're like, oh, four down left.
Yeah, they're good at that. Like, I just find it hard to find the actual staff member sometimes.
Well, yeah, you have to wander around a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. Bunnings is a funny place. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about. Hospitality, not Bunnings.
Mm.
But yeah, I don't know. It's just weird. There's just this weird sort of expectation. And it is hospitality, and you are paying for the service. But, like, isn't it funny that we talk about how if you don't acknowledge someone in the first, you know, 20 seconds of them arriving at your venue, like, you've almost, like, you know, you've almost fucked up your first impression.
The flip side for me is I very much expect someone to do that in a hospitality venue, but I fucking hate it in retail.
Yeah,
when
that's
someone's
true
standing
too
by the door and's like, hey, how are you? And I'm like, fuck off.
Yeah, can I? And, like, or like, you're like browsing for just a minute and they're like, can I help you with something?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and I'm like, leave me be.
I'm leaving.
So I guess I'm, failed that kind of double standard as well.
Yeah, no, it's true.
But yeah, I think that goes a long way. And I think that it's something you notice in the better venues straight away, whether it's a bar, cafe, restaurant, deli.
But what, like, how do you... This is the intangible part. It's like, because when it comes to service, and it depends on what type of venue you're at, there's like this sort of, this perfect balance of casual but professional and familiar, but also, you know, like that sort of professionalism as well. It's like you can't be too casual and you can't be too familiar, and but you have to have a bit of that in there in order to be... I don't know. It's really hard to train people to do.
I think you have to pick the right people. Some people are just kind of better at that in their own personality.
Well, that's it. People are...
But it also kind of...
people are themselves, I
guess. Yeah, it also comes from the train. Like, it's one thing we spoke a lot about when we first took over Cavo, because the service was very formal before we took over, to the point of it was, you know, it was Sir and Madame and...
That's
your
so
back
old
and,
school
and,
now.
Yeah,
eh?
Yeah, it was very
hand behind
old school.
The back.
Yeah, and like just little things like that.
What's the old towel, like tea towel over the front of the forearm situation?
I mean, yeah,
is that a thing? Like, what is that?
It's kind of, I'm not even sure like what that's about. Like, you kind of, I mean, you always have a tea towel on you, and like sommeliers, like you kind of the proper way of doing wine is you take the foil off and you wipe it with a cloth, take the cork out, you wipe it down with a cloth again, and then you use the cloth to catch any drips from the wine. So there's kind of a...
What's that thing of, like, wrapping the bottle in a cloth and then pouring it while you hold the cloth?
There's a lot of old school ceremony and the ways thing you do. And there was a lot of that. And we wanted to get rid of that. It is becoming more and more old school. And it's just kind of pointless pomp.
I'm going to keep going on because I find this stuff weird and interesting. But have you ever seen, I've been watching, you know, like you get these odd things pop up on Facebook or whatever, where like they use like they heat up this steel thing in order to open up a bottle of port, where they like...
There is some reason behind that.
So the sediment doesn't...
So, yeah, I mean, like port and Madeira and things like that.
Oh, the cork.
They can be... Like, they age for... Like, you can have 100-year-old Madeira and port, and they'll be, like, fine to drink. So when a wine's that old, the cork can be fucked. So it's very hard to get that cork out. So by just literally snapping the neck off, you don't have to do it. So there was reason behind it.
I understand that.
I mean, if you were doing it to a young bottle of port, it would be very pointless and only ceremonial.
Yeah.
There's lots of shit like that. So we wanted to get rid of a lot of that. But then also we were aware that there is still a group of customers who like that level of attentiveness and want to be kind of treated when they're out on a night out. Generalization, but normally more of an older crowd.
Yeah.
I was actually talking about this the other day, about kind of why that was. Why younger people prefer this more casual, friendly kind of style of service, whereas older people want that kind of special treat feeling. And I think it kind of comes down to the fact that going out to a restaurant, like, quite often and regularly is quite a recent thing.
Yeah.
Like, in the 80s, it was... I mean, the affordability of restaurants has changed a lot. In the 80s, it was a lot more expensive to dine out, and it was very much for that treat. So people would save up for quite a while to go to their local restaurant, like, you know, the Charcoal Tavern in Wollongong back in the day. And because they saved up and spent that money, and it was seen as more of a rich person's thing, I guess they wanted to be treated that way.
Yeah.
And there might just be a kind of residual knock-on from that.
There must be.
Speculating. But it kind of seems to add up. Whereas for younger people, we've been used to going out to restaurants once a week, this, you know, more casual, cheaper vibe, and we don't feel that we need that ceremony and that pomp.
Yeah. It's the same when it comes to cafes. Like, the amount that people go out and spend money on coffee and breakfast now is out of control compared to what it used to be.
I mean, every weekday for some people, or, you know, every weekend even. Yeah, just the thoughts that keep me awake at night.
Yeah. What do you think, in terms of, like, we'll try to get back to what makes a good venue. Mm. We talked a little bit about sort of service style and how to get that right.
Well, I mean, the point that I went off and was trying to make was that we knew kind of for every thing we relaxed and made more friendly and casual, we kind of needed to up something somewhere else. And that generally was the knowledge of our staff. So as if we stop doing this little thing, they need to have that extra layer of knowledge about the food, about the wine, that extra kind of confidence. Because I think that's the only way to allow your staff to kind of be themselves to a certain degree and have that kind of more natural, flowy personability. Mm. And then the other thing we kind of... obviously hired people we liked and thought would be good people to have, and we tried to let a bit of their personality come out within the confines of the knowledge and the style of our service. And I think that helped our staff be more relaxed, rather than being like telling them you have to act this way and then it's going to be stifled and fake and false.
Well, that's I guess one of the tough things as well is training staff to exercise judgment in how much they think a table wants to be interacted with or spoken to.
Yeah.
Because there are some people that they literally just want you to put the dish in front of them and say, that's the chicken. And then put the dish in front of the other person and say, that's the fish.
Yeah.
Not go like, so we've got the chicken that's been poached. There's people that just don't want a bar of it. I mean, they just want to eat their food.
And that's a tough one. And sometimes you can kind of get it wrong. Sometimes people can be quite quiet to start. So you do start to like pull back on your descriptions and speed them up so they can get on. And then halfway through the meal, maybe after a glass of wine or two, they'll suddenly become more interested. And you're like, oh shit, I've been kind of shortchanging them a bit. So you kind of try and compensate. So, but like it is certain people are better at reading, you know, social cues, social situations. And I guess it's trying to bring that out of people and train people. But again, it's very intangible. And as a customer, you don't really notice when it's done well.
Mm.
And you shouldn't notice when it's done well. You're kind of more likely to notice when it's done badly.
Yeah. You guys at Caveau would have Tom, one of the chefs, run food.
Mm.
Why did you choose to do that, and what do you think it adds? Because I think it's great. I loved it when you'd have a chat with the chef, just because coming from a, but like that's me coming from a hospo background and being one of those like top one percenters of how interested I am in the food itself.
Mm.
Like, tell us about that.
I think it makes people feel a bit special when the chef comes out for some reason.
Yeah. It's kind of old school in a way, though, too, right? Like, isn't that an old thing? Like, it's like at the end of the night, the chef would come out and shake hands with people at the table.
I said, a little bit, like, that kind of part of it, I think, was always a bit more self-congratulatory of the chef.
Right.
Kind of wanted to go out for the glory at the end of the meal, for people to say, like, oh, my God, it was so good. What we tried to do is was for more of a kind of communication point of view.
Yeah, I suppose.
But, I mean, it used to be, and, until fairly recently, restaurants were owned by the maitre d', and they were the kind of star of the show, to the point where they would even maybe write the menus and they'd employ chefs to cook their menu. It's only actually a fairly recent shift where chef owners have been a thing.
Yeah, you explained that to me the other day, and I was like, I didn't even know about that.
So it's possibly a thing where customers used to have that interaction with the owner on the floor, whereas now, look, you know, the chef seems to be in the kitchen. So, I mean, for that, it makes customers feel special. They enjoy it. Also, it's as much as you can train your staff, they're not going to be as knowledgeable as the person who's, you know, cooking the food, knows the menu, knows the suppliers, knows the stories, knows exactly how to describe it. Especially for us, like, we had a mainly casual front of house crew, so it's always hard to ask people who are doing one, two shifts a week to know this much. Our staff were really fucking good at that, and we're amazing at learning all our menus and learning all the stories and actually reading the probably way too long notes I used to write about the food and wine. But it can still be difficult to get it across. I mean, we took some quite drastic measures of, most restaurants will do a menu tasting, they'll do up like one dish of each of the menu, and then seven staff pick at it a little bit.
Yeah.
We started doing that and just realized it was not putting our staff in the customer's seat, literally. So every time we changed the menu, we'd let our staff come in pairs or on their own, and eat the whole menu with the matched wines.
Really?
And Tom and I would come out and explain each course wine.
At a service?
Yeah, for free.
Awesome.
On a quiet night, obviously, if we were quiet.
That's mad.
Which I don't really know of too many other places doing. But it made a lot of sense for us that our staff would know the menu, be invested in the menu, and just, you can't know what a customer feels if you're not, even to the point of, like, when you're sitting down, you are looking at a plate of food differently to the way the chef looks at it on the pass. You're at a different angle, it's different lighting. So if you don't sit down and eat that plate of food in the same place as customers, you can't know what the customer's seeing, tasting, experiencing.
Yeah.
Even things like the way aromas die down from that time from the kitchen to outside, the way like the temperature changes. So there's so many variables when food leaves the pass that for us it was the only way for us to really, you know, train our staff and even train ourselves to know what we're doing. And that made an intangible difference, we felt.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm.
That's always difficult. And I don't know, like, it's just always so tough, and especially in a regional area, especially like a place like Wollongong, especially where there's so many uni students and stuff like that, is that, like, to be able to try to get staff to invest in what they're doing and not just think of it as a job that they're trying to just make some money so they can get on the piss, which is what they're doing sometimes, but not all the time, but just to actually invest, it's a tough challenge.
Yeah, I think the best venues are nice places to work, so then the staff enjoy it there, the staff invest more, the staff will learn more, obviously good staff training is good, and that shows kind of across the board, I think. So I mean, yeah, that's, service is a hard one to get right.
Alright, let's sort of sidestep to other aspects of what makes venues good. Now, if we're talking about still on restaurants, I reckon, like, it it feels like at the moment, particularly with like food culture in, say, like in a lot of places, but I'm a sucker for a little bit of grandiosity in a place, like especially if it's a special occasion.
Yeah.
So like, you've got your like neighborhood restaurants, like a lot of like small and more independent neighborhood restaurants in a place like Sydney, like your Esther's and Monopole and like those smaller spots. And then you've got the larger, more what you'd probably call fancier places like Bennelong and Aria and places that where there's a bit of grandiosity about it. And like for me, I don't know. Maybe it's just that because of a string of good experiences I've had, but like a place that has like a place that's like a striking venue. A place that's like a striking venue with a nice view. It fucking makes a world of difference to me, actually. Hey, I really like it.
Yeah,
like,
I think it obviously depends who you're kind of dining with and the experience you want. Like, I don't think me and you would go to Aria.
No.
Like,
no, not just us.
Like, that would feel a bit weird.
No,
but like,
yeah,
for a special occasion, for a date, like, I had an amazing experience at Aria last time. I went going again in 2 days, in fact.
Yes.
And it was like, but you can't just have, like, the view there is amazing, the dining room is amazing, but it can only actually add if the food, the wine, the service is on point.
Yeah.
And I think there, they really do nail it. It's, the service is,
Man, this rain's hectic.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I wonder how much this is affecting the sound.
Yeah, maybe. We'll find out.
Anyway, just keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, like everything's on point there. Like, the food's great. The wine's fantastic. All the staff are very knowledgeable. It's very slick. And then to top it off, you're sitting in this great room looking at this amazing view. So I think that can only be the icing on the cake. Like somewhere, if it was a great view, an amazing dining room, but the food was shit and the wine was shit, it would be a shit experience.
Yeah.
So it's those little extras and the... Yeah, you know, the frustrating thing is it's not something you can really develop. You either have a good view or you don't. Yeah, you either look at the Harbour Bridge or you look at Kira Street.
Yeah,
like it's, you can't really fake it. But
yeah, I want to tell you about when I went to Bennelong. I don't know. I really fucking liked Bennelong. Hey,
yeah,
like it might have just been the occasion and stuff. We went there for my auntie's 60th birthday, and we went there as a family, like eight of us or something like that. And I don't know, there was just something so cool like about it. We went there for lunch, the view was amazing. It was just like, it just had this sort of feeling of occasion just being in a place like that.
Yeah.
And then also one thing which we can move on to, I guess, is it was a la carte. So it's just like three course a la carte menu.
Mm.
And for me, that was actually like refreshingly nice.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To not have to actually try to pick with the person that you're dining with to share it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And also for it not to be a really long
tasting
menu with like drawn out descriptions of everything. It was just like everyone got three courses, everyone chose what they want.
Yeah.
And there was like the odd sharing of a bite of this here or there and stuff like that, but it was like, one thing that I missed was like, you're like, oh, how's the marinade or whatever? And they're like, oh, this is, this is great.
What's yours like? I'll give you a little bit of mine.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me do you a little bit. And
Yeah,
something quite nice about
it's something,
that.
Yeah, I loved it. And you don't get, fuck, man. Like, I don't know when the last time I had an a la carte menu was.
But I think like,
I mean, it's a pain in the ass.
If I go to a top restaurant, I want to have the tasting menu.
Yeah.
Like for me. As a chef,
yeah,
I want to see what they got and I want to see the flow of it. And but I think like kind of what we're maybe getting onto is congruency in a venue. Like I want, like if I'm going to Aria, if I'm going to Bentley, Bennelong, I want a slick, like, you know, friendly, approachable, but I still want it to be very professional, very knowledgeable.
Yeah,
if it's like, you know, the your cafe, like, you want them to be more chill, like chatty, like, you know, because you're going to make friends of people. you know, if it's a local bar I go to, I want the staff to be fucking funny, like loud, obnoxious, and just fucking pour me shots.
Yeah.
Like, but I, like, if actually, I, funny, when I went to the bridge room, just before it won three hats, one of the front of house staff just, he didn't, like, he was, like, funny dude, and I kind of, like, liked him being in hospo, but he just kind of didn't, the way he talked, the way he looked, the way he acted, just didn't really fit the venue or anything else. And it kind of, like, looking back, like, you know, when you leave a restaurant and you kind of have a little rundown with your partner you went with, he was kind of the thing that we spoke about more, and it kind of detracted from the food and the wine a bit.
What was he doing?
He was just, like, just a bit, like, brash, and, like, he was, like, part-time, and he used to, I think he used to be a full-time, but he was, like, we're like, oh, so do you work at, like, another restaurant or bar? And he's like, nah, work in construction now. And, like, and he, like, knew his stuff about wine, and, like, he just kind of, like, made some, like, funny little jokes that, like, again, like, I was like, fuck, that's pretty funny. But I'm like, maybe that's anyone else here. So maybe you're just reading the table a bit. But it just didn't quite fit with the style there. Like, he would fit in a restaurant that was more chill, bit more kind of out there. And, you know, but he just, it didn't quite fit in with the bridge room, which was very corporate, slick, beige restaurant in some ways. So I think that's important, is to, you know, tailor your... And there's actually a lot of places I've been to where... the service doesn't match the clientele or what they're doing. And it can be like that when new places open, because they think they're going to go one way, think they get one customer base, and it's hard to choose exactly who your customer base are, so you have to kind of react to that at times. But I think, yeah, definitely, like, making sure the style of service and the style of food and, like, the decor, the, you know, the timings, make sure they all fit together nicely to make it a completely, you know, a fairly seamless experience.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Sometimes you can have amazing food that you just can't argue is delicious, and you can't put your finger on, like, anything negative about the service. Like, the service could have been completely good and fine. Yeah. But it's for some reason, it's just not a wonderful or memorable, like, that memorable of an experience.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, moving on to kind of food-wise, the biggest thing that I find, is, like, the most basic thing, is literally fucking people not seasoning the food properly.
Yeah.
Like, and it happens, like, at all levels, I find, like, from, you know, cafes to sort of more high-end restaurants to mid-price. And it can just, like... And the food can be, like, almost executed perfectly. There's just not that little bit of salt. There's not that squeeze of lemon. There's not that acid. And it just fucks it. Yeah. And, like, especially for me, like...
It's odd, isn't it, how common it is for food to... Oh, like, I don't know if I like my food saltier than, like... what correct seasoning might be on some objective scale.
Yeah.
But, like, it's pretty frequent for me that, like, I want more salt. Like, when I go out, like, not that often, but, like, it's quite a few times where I'm, like, looking around for a salt shaker and I'm like, where's the salt shaker? Like,
yeah.
I mean, and as you say, at all levels, like, the amount of pubs that you go to, and they don't season the chips when you order a schnitty. Yeah. It's like, what,
that's,
are you
wild?
What are you thinking?
Yeah,
like,
that's then, a sin.
Yeah, like, how? Like, you just putting chips.
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe the split actually, like, on the kind of lower to mid range restaurants, it's normally, like, salt, and then a bit higher up, a lot of time it's lack of acidity.
Yeah,
and that's really key. Like, that's kind of, it's almost stereotypical. Like, or whenever you do up a new dish and you taste it, 9 times out of 10, it needs more acidity. And that's kind of just repeated throughout high-end kitchens. It always needs more acidity on that. Because that really does, like, really takes that level of food that little bit higher.
Yeah.
If you get that right. And then, like, a bit higher than that then is texture balance in a dish. Like, a lot of time, things can just be very one-dimensional texturally.
Yeah.
And that kind of just ruins it on your palate. So there's little things like that happen all the time. And that just comes down... Like, and it is tough to, like, taste everything that goes out, like during a service, like your fucking mouth gets pretty like,
yeah,
just shitty, like for 3 hours of tasting these different things. But you, like, you really have to do it if you want your food to be good. And like a lot of people, like I guess I probably notice it more, but a lot of people won't be able to put their finger on what was wrong with the food. They'll just know it wasn't great.
Yeah. But it's interesting like that too, because it's like you and I, like with experience cooking and whatever, it's like when something's bland or something could be better, like you do what you need to do to adjust it. Like, yeah. Even, I mean, I might be a pain in the ass at a cafe, but like I'll often like ask for some like a wedge of lemon,
yeah,
at a cafe. If I've got like some form of avo toast with like an egg or something with some, yeah, smoked salmon or something like that, like even like whatever, like zucchini fritters or some shit like that, it's often that you do, like, I'm just like, this is satisfactory, but with some nice salt,
yeah,
and just a twist of pepper and a little like squeeze of lemon over the plate, I've just exponentially improved it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that just don't, they just accept that food is kind of bland. Like, yeah. I've been to that many cafes or bars or whatever with people and we've eaten and I'm like, what's that like? And they're like, it's kind of bland. I'm like, do some shit to it. Fucking put some salt on there. Yeah. Don't be afraid to ask for shit.
I'm bad like that. They're like, I'll like basically never ask for salt or like more salt or like in a restaurant.
Really?
I think it's because I like probably got like...
It's because you think that people know who you are.
I mean, not always, sometimes. No. But like if it's somewhere local, then like maybe. And then like I probably have a mildly snobby reputation anyway with some people. I don't want to exacerbate that. And I'm just like, it's just like, I don't like it when it happens. But in my ego, I'm like, that's because the customer's wrong when they say it's my
food. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the funny thing. Like, having worked in kitchens and stuff like that, I remember distinctly working at a place and I was on the floor and it was this middle-aged woman. And I said, like, how was that? And she goes, it was under-seasoned. And I was like, all right. And I passed it on to the chef, like, kind of as you do. I said, she said it was under-seasoned. And he just said, well, that fucking bitch doesn't know what she's talking about. Like, which is like, what? What percentage of the time is that the response from the chef?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think, like, you do have to be honest with yourself. And obviously, if you can, like, taste what they've eaten. But this is, like, maybe what marks out better chefs, worse chefs, is being able to taste objectively rather than subjectively.
Yeah.
So, subjectively would be like, that's perfectly seasoned for me. But you kind of have to know your palate and gauge your palate against maybe the average and the mean. Because everyone's palate's different. Like, the natural salinity level of your saliva makes a difference to how much salt you need.
Yeah.
So you need to go match or exceed that for actual salt to, you know, work, as it were. So it's very hard to please everyone.
Yeah.
But you need to season your food to a way that you think is going to be kind of the best way to please everyone, as it were, and then stick by that. And if someone says it's under-seasoned, you can kind of confidently say, it's not under-seasoned, it's under-seasoned for you. That is the level I season at, which pleases as many people as possible. You can't win everybody.
But what's the, like... There's so many places that would not have salt on the table because it's a pride thing that, like, we season our food perfectly.
Yeah.
We season our poo perfectly. We season our food perfectly. So they don't have salt on the table. But then it's like, well, if we acknowledge that everyone's got a different, like, spectrum of how seasoned or how much salt they like on their food, then why don't we just acknowledge that by putting some salt on the table?
It's maybe a kind of almost like a statement. By not doing it, being like, we are confident in our food that you should not need salt.
Yeah.
Like, if people ask for salt at Cavo, we'd give it to them with minimal bluster and fuss in the kitchen.
Yeah.
But like that, I mean, it's a very obvious one, but like that is probably just the thing that, like, spoils more food and more meals than anything else, really.
Yeah.
Because again, totally. If you're not getting the food right, then you just...
Mate, you can make... Good. Like, imagine just like having pasta, plain pasta with unsalted butter on it, yeah. as opposed to plain pasta with yeah. salted butter on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like...
Yeah. I think like, and I've been, a lot of time it's almost like frustrating when something's just not seasoned properly, cause especially if it's like, it's good food, they put a lot of effort into it, it's good ingredients, and then it's just under seasoned, and you're like, oh fuck, like if you just seasoned that properly, this would be delicious, this would be really, really good.
You gotta
just
ask, like, form... you gotta ask for the salt.
No, I don't ask for the salt.
Okay,
no,
if no, we just... dine together and I find something under seasoned, I'll be asking for salt.
Well, it happened the other day.
Between your legs.
Happened the other day, and I was looking around, and you were like, what are you looking for? And I'm like, nothing. You were like, are you looking for salt? And I was like, yeah. And you were like, ask for someone. I'm like, no. No chance.
Yeah, no, nah, man. But yeah, I don't know. I always ask for salt.
Mm.
Like, especially if there's a bread at the start. If there's a bread course at the start and they just give you olive oil or they just give you butter, I always like a bit of extra little
Dear.
Flake of salt here and there. And it's just yeah. like, fuck, it makes a big difference for me. And I'm...
Yeah.
I don't know. There's that weird thing, though, right? That, like... Restaurants should... They're there to serve the people, like, a lot of the time. And you kind of have to put your ego to one side in some way where it's like, just give the motherfuckers, like, what they want. Like, maybe to, you know, like, to a level. But if people want salt, like...
Well, I don't know, you, like, have to have it on the table. But, like...
No.
I think, like, if you really... If someone is salt and you refuse to give them any, that's, like, a... That's an ego trip.
Yeah, totally.
But I guess probably a lot of chefs don't really understand or know that, like, people's palates are actually different. And at the point, like, I think the coriander thing is always a little bit eye-opening. That, like, the people who, like, really don't like coriander, that's actually, like, a genetic thing.
Yeah.
Like, to a lot of people, coriander tastes like soap. So, like, you can't...
Coriander is an odd-tasting thing, though, I think. I remember when I first...
Does it taste like soap
tried
to you?
Coriander. No, it's not like... I mean, I like it. But I remember when I first tried coriander, I didn't like it. I don't know. I feel like it's something
you
kind of got
to get
used to.
Did you just eat coriander? Or, like, was it...
I don't know, mate. I don't know.
I feel like I can't remember, like, the first...
Is there any food that
coriander?
You don't like?
I don't really like olives much.
Really?
They just don't do it for me. Like, I don't mind them if they're, like... in something, like used as an ingredient, but like if it's a bowl of olives, I'm just like, nah, I don't really like them.
Yeah. Fair enough.
What else? There's like, what was the other thing I don't like? Like shitty mushrooms, I don't like.
Shitty mushrooms.
Yeah, like or like shitty mushrooms cooked wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Like when they're just like black and lipid and slimy.
Yeah. Right.
Like love a wild mushroom though.
Love
a chanterelle or a morel.
Yeah.
All the good ones. A porcini.
Man.
All good mushrooms.
Can you get fresh chanterelles and morels in Australia? Fresh?
Yeah, it's hard. Porcinis grow in South Australia. I've got some from before. I think you can get wild morels here.
Because, like, I know that in the States... Like, morel foraging's big. It's
yeah,
like a big thing.
Yeah,
probably in
like,
Europe too.
In the UK, there's a much larger selection of wild mushroomed, easily forageable. But then on the flip side, there's actually more types of native Australian truffle than there are European ones.
What do you mean native?
There's native truffles.
Wild truffle?
Wild native Australian truffles.
Where do the wild truffles grow?
In the ground.
Where?
Well, they're quite hard to find, and no one who's managed to track them has found one that's actually worth eating.
Right.
But there's...
Are they black truffles, or are they just, like, random?
Well, I don't know. Like, again, this is something I read about a while ago. There's, like, thousands of different species of native truffle.
And they grow on, like, eucalypt roots.
Yeah, or various tree roots.
Native.
Yeah, yeah. Like I haven't got too much information. I just know it
Well, I think you need to read up on that, mate. I'd love to come on this podcast and start.
Well, there's thousands of different types, and they're obviously they're not researched or actually looked at. But it's just the fact there's
thousands of different types. Some of them would be delicious, right?
You might be able to hit the jackpot with one.
Yeah.
but again, like this knowledge like this is been lost.
Train some pigs.
Well, yeah, you can't just train a pig to eat to find any truffle. You've got to train him to specifically look out for that truffle.
What are your thoughts on white versus black truffle?
First time I had white truffles, my boss, because he had never had a white truffle before, which is quite surprising because he was a restaurant critic, spent like £300, like $600, on this little white truffle from Alba, where they grow. And after work one night, he was very excited, and he was like, "What should we do with it?" And we're like, "Let's just keep it simple. Let's just do a very basic risotto, and we'll just fucking chuck heaps of truffle on it." So me and the sous chef spent like, you know, clean down, like, "Let's make this for us." We had the truffles had been in the rice overnight, had like a stock. So making this risotto, taking our time in it. Heaps of truffle in the end, heaps of truffle on top. And then we all sat down and we all sort of started eating it. And we were all just like, "Yep, tastes like truffle."
Pretty mild or what?
Just tasted like truffle, really. Like, yeah. It just wasn't blow us away £600, $600 worth. Mm. You know, that would have been like, what was it, like maybe... four or five of
it's
us?
A weird thing. Like, truffles are so weird because this, like, the smell is stronger. There's a few things out there where the smell is much stronger than the flavor.
Yeah.
I think.
So, like, I mean, my experience with white truffle was it wasn't anything particularly better than black truffle.
Yeah, right.
Let's move on to
bars. Like, I mean, there's so many different types of bars out there, but essentially, like, what you're trying to do when you go to a bar is have fun, right?
I think. But I mean, it kind of depends on. There's some bars where your fun's going to come from who you're with, and there's some bars where the staff can really kind of set the tone.
That's true.
For the bar, but I still think, like, for one, like I said, like, greeting the customer, such a simple thing, and, you know, greetings vary, but that's just so key. And I think, like, then in like a good bar, I definitely want the staff to have knowledge about the drinks, like. Especially if there's a, you know, something where there's, like, if a bar's got, like, 15 different beers, like, and I'm looking at the menu, I'm not just going to be able to really, unless it's something I know or have tried and really like. But, like, so a lot of bars around here, I'll just be like, "I want a sour beer." And I want them to, you know, try them, to know about them, to be like, "We've got this, and this. You know, this is tasty. I tried this earlier. This is great. I'm not sure about this." Like, I want that knowledge. From the staff, and I think that's key to take your bar to the next level. Mm. Like, nothing worse than like what wines have you got? And they're like, "Oh, got a red and a white, a couple of different ones." And you're like, "Right."
I think with bars, for me, lighting is so key, and it's the same for restaurants as well.
Yeah,
but like, fuck, lighting makes a difference. And it's funny because, like, it's almost like there's this, like, extremely obvious thing, right, where the proprietors either do pay attention to lighting or don't pay attention to lighting.
Yeah.
And it's immediately apparent when you walk into a place. It's like, "Oh, yep, they've got little lights on the walls over there. They've got, like, these nice pendants here that are, like, a warm colour. Mm. They're dimmed." And then, conversely, you can have just... a place that just has these bright fucking white downlights stuck in the gyprock.
I think that can also depend on the fit out of the venue as well. Like, some venues take to more, you know, brighter lighting. Others don't.
Yeah.
And they're going to be congruent with it.
What, like, do you mean? Like, what sort of a place would you...
I mean, just
takes,
like,
the brighter lighting.
Take, like, Throsby, for instance. If Throsby was really dark, it would be a bit weird because the fit out of the bar, where it's very light and airy.
Yeah.
And then if the Wolf was really bright, that would be weird because you'd see everything.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I feel like...
I just mean that, like dark lighting isn't always, like...
No, not dark. Not dark.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, I don't know. It just makes a huge difference to me. Yeah. I just can't stand over lit places, and I just feel really just like Jesus.
Yeah, I don't think you got. Yeah, I think like little things like that, lighting, music levels.
Yeah, music is huge.
Like, and the type of music for one. I hate places that play very specific music. Well, maybe it's just places that play the music I don't like. Because if I went somewhere and they just played like old rock or old rhythm blues, I'd be slow. This is sick. But if I go somewhere that's playing fucking house music constantly, I'd be like, that's crap. So maybe it's just the venue should play the music that I like. But I think there's safer genres to play.
Yeah.
Like Parrot, we don't play anything.
Well, I think when it comes to bars, it's like if you've got a DJ.
Yeah.
Like even if it's just they're just mixing like. Doesn't matter. Kind of doesn't matter what they're mixing, but it's someone who's paying attention to the music and it's kind of flowing. And what a DJ's job is to kind of gauge the vibe of the patrons and sort of adjust accordingly and stuff. I feel like that's like such a big
tempo
difference.
And the vibe of it. Like when we did the with Kavo, I wanted to play good music for one.
Yep. It's a good start.
Yeah, because it used to play bad music. So, but I kind of want to do like kind of like old rhythm and blues, some soul-y stuff, some modern things. And I was kind of, and a bit, it all had to be very even. Like a track couldn't have like a suddenly kind of jump out loud guitar solo.
Yeah.
Because that would just be very apparent when you're trying to eat. So I had to like, took fucking ages and I had to like basically do a playlist from scratch. And I just had to like keep, obviously there's some songs I knew I quite liked that fitted. But a lot of times I just had to like scroll through stuff, listen to basically the whole track just to see if it was like evenly pitched the whole way.
Yeah, okay.
So it wouldn't just like have this kind of this jolt to the customers. and that was quite...
Jesus!
Yeah, it was quite a big thing. And like, and we did get some... It's funny, it died off very quickly. We did get some complaints about the music. Like people being like, oh, you shouldn't play this music in this venue. And it was like...
What were you playing? Like,
it was just some slightly like... The playlist hardly changed. Like we took a couple of things off that didn't, maybe just stood out a little bit, but people just had this very like specific thought of what Kavo was and what music we should be playing, and like would try and tell us what music to play. And then after like a couple of months, we never had another complaint again. It was really weird. We just scared all of them off. sound level. I mean, and then like the actual sound. Like some bars sound good when. It's just like it's a good sound of people talking. Other times it can just be so overpowering that you can't really hear the people next to you.
Yeah, well, that goes for restaurants as well. I think that like attention to noise suppression, like can be a big one. There's nothing worse, and like I think like a lot of owners out there probably recognize when their venue is too loud, and it's like an echoey space, but it's an expensive investment sometimes to dampen noise, to suppress noise.
And especially with, it's less fashionable now, but for a little while, the kind of fashion for restaurant fit out was very industrial, stark, open rooms. And that did not do well with noise suppression.
No.
And that was just the way things were. Like, the opened up ducts that like taking the ceiling up, it's very hard to control noise then without kind of soft furnishings, which weren't cool. There's quite a lot of tech things you can do and companies you can go to, but they can be expensive.
I remember recently going out for dinner and the person that I was with, like, they just had the shits because it was too loud and like it was annoying.
I think I read, might be wrong, but Aubergine in Canberra, when they refitted a couple of years ago, and they reopened after fit out, and they realised they'd kind of just messed up the, or hadn't thought of, or messed up the noise in there and hadn't put enough noise dampening in. So then they put this actually like really beautiful, what's the actual word for it? Fucking
Like draped linen? Is that what you're talking about?
Like,
are you talking about the wall or the...
They put all this stuff in the ceiling. What's like a word for like noise dampening? I feel like there's actual... reverberation, echo. What's the actual...
I don't know.
I'm trying to think. I feel like there's a better word. We keep on skirting around it. Anyway, they I think they acknowledged that in a... I feel like they acknowledged it on an Instagram post, and they actually put this like really beautiful noise dampening, sound dampening stuff on the roof, which actually became like, it actually looks like really well done.
Yeah, so they put like a... They hung material.
Yeah,
it looks like an art installation.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah, exactly.
This hanging material.
Yeah, and actually, I think the dining room probably looks better for it. So there's obviously ways of doing it better. But definitely, it's owner operators who spend time in the venue and think and look and try everything, like. We spent a lot of time configuring our table layout and working out what size tables we could fit for each kind of spot in the dining room and ways we could maximize space, even like the heights of the table and like heights of seats and things like when we were ever planning anything, actually like sitting in that space and working out if that works.
And to
quite minute details, really. Like, sometimes we'd just be arguing over, like, the smallest little detail, whether it was aesthetic or, like, the wording we'll use on a menu. Like when we were opening or redoing the menu for Parrot, Tom and I were, like, at Kavod at, like, 4 a.m. And we'd worked, like, a 16-hour shift already. And we just ended up having a 40-minute conversation of how to put, like, we recommend you have... these like this many dishes,
yeah,
because I'm always a little bit like shitty with like that kind of thing. We're like, how do we word it? And we just had this like very long conversation, and it probably didn't matter, but like the fact that we did that with almost anything made a difference. Like, it all added up because we would look at these like tiny little details.
Well, that's
how
what like
better.
Kind of it's interesting because it's like that's the story of running a successful business, right? Is like, it's such a low margin enterprise that you have to put every single chip in your corner in as best as you possibly can to try to maximize the experience that people have and their potential to spread their experience via word of mouth or to return themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And as much as it sounds like it's frivolous to have a 40-minute conversation about the way you word one sentence on your menu, it's like all of those little 1%ers, 0.5%ers and things like that
and
are just so important.
Almost like when occasionally we would do this and we'd know we're having a fucking, like this really wasn't going to make a tangible difference at all, but it was just the way we did things. So there was no way of us not having that about that wording, because that's just the way we're all doing things. If we didn't have that that thought process about everything, then the things it did make a difference to, we wouldn't have done them either.
Mm.
Make sense? Probably worded that a bit weird. So a 40-minute conversation about how I could do it better.
Well, I mean, I feel like this is a good start. You could keep going down this road for ages, but basically what we're talking about is the small things that make venues good. And I hope that everyone got something out of it, right? What do you reckon? Do you reckon they did?
Yeah. I mean, like... Yeah, it's just that there's so many small little things, and again, I think the thing being is that you especially people who aren't in hospitality, you won't notice them when they're done, but you'll notice that something's not quite right when they're not done.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of the key, and that's good owner operators look at those little tiny things and make things better. Kind of like when we were chatting to the Mary's guys about how they spend a lot of time on the things that really matter and then don't give a fuck about the things that don't matter. And I think that makes a difference in their experience and why they're successful and generally why people like that are successful.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Thanks, Simon. Let's leave it then.
Yeah, well, I'm home now, so it's a natural end.
The end. Thanks.
What's up?
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.